Hello, hello, and welcome back to another episode of Minority Report's podcast and digital series. I am your host, Mona Sheikh. You guys, I know we're doing this earlier. We usually do it at like 6:15 Pacific, but today's a special day because besides having a special guest, I am part of a stand-up comedy competition, and that's happening at like 6:30 p.m., so there was no way in hell I would be able to do the live stream and be able to do the comedy competition because I need to like focus and win some cash on this comedy competition. But today, joining us is a fabulous guest who I had the pleasure of discovering while flipping channels and came across this amazing news network called Cheddar. And next thing you know, I'm just like, wait, there's this gorgeous, smart, brilliant South Asian woman who's the anchor. I must reach out to her immediately. And I was like, God, I'm sure she's busy. I don't know if she has time for me. And I got lucky, and she actually made time for me. So I'm very, very, very grateful. Let me just give you a little rundown on how fabulous Nora Ali is, my guest, okay? She is a graduate of Harvard. She has done, she's a classical pianist. She's just an overachiever, and she makes me want to go back to school. So here's my very talented friend, Nora Ali. How are you?
Wow, I'm so good, Mona. That might be the best intro I've ever gotten. So really? I appreciate that. Thank you so much. Besides when like my mother or my sisters introduced me, because they're a little biased. So I do appreciate it.
No, you're most welcome. I came across your information and I was like, oh my God, I gotta know everything about Nora. Nora, you went to Harvard and you had papers that you were working on for cancer research while you were at Harvard?
Oh goodness. Okay, so I did a little bit of cancer research in high school, but my older sister actually is a pediatric oncologist. So Nicole Ali, Nicole McNear. So she is amazing. She majored in biophysics and she went to Yale Medical School. So we have a lot of scientists and doctors in my family, which I find very cool.
Got it. So let's back up. So now you are first generation Bangladeshi, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
So you're first generation Bangladeshi and your parents came here like that immigrant story that we have. Was your dad a doctor or a scientist or?
Both my parents are scientists. So they met in Bangladesh. They got married. They came to the U.S. for graduate school on scholarship. They had barely any money growing up in Bangladesh. They're both PhD chemists and they went to graduate school in Kentucky. Like when they arrived in the US, it was in Kentucky in the South. They didn't understand the accents. Their first meal in the US, I kid you not, was White Castle. And they were like, is this American food? And then they went to Colorado for postgraduate school. And then they ended up in Minnesota to work at 3M, which is Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. A very, big consumer products company. So yeah, they're scientists. As I mentioned, my older sister is a doctor, cancer researcher, and practices as well. So here I am, just in the news, doing broadcast journalism. Quite a different path, especially for immigrant families, South Asian families.
And it's three of you. It's three mm-hmm. sisters, right?
That's right. Yeah. My little sister is in Minnesota as well. She works at 3M. She works in client relationship management. So yeah, my family is kind of all over the place, different industries.
And your younger sister is in the medical profession too, or?
No, she works at 3M. She works in client relationship management. Yeah. Wow. I didn't think I would end up in television really, because as you're, well aware, the paths are kind of laid out for you when you're the child of immigrants. Either you're a doctor or a lawyer or a scientist. And my parents were open to the idea of business and finance because my sister's husband, worked at a hedge fund. So I did that first when I graduated college. I majored in quantitative finance. And then I circuitously arrived working in television, but covering business. So it kind of worked out.
Got it. Well, your parents were like, hey, what are you doing? Like, were you one of those folks who was just like, maybe I'll go in entertainment? Was entertainment part of like the conversation, or it was just like an accident?
A little bit of both. Growing up, you mentioned I'm a pianist. I'm also a violinist. So I grew up performing and competing a lot. And as a result of that, I would MC and host different things as well, fundraisers, friends and family weddings, that sort of thing. So I always had this desire to be on stage. And then after I worked in finance, I then went to work for a startup in tech. And then I decided, you know what? I'm like in my late 20s. I feel this itch to work in entertainment and television and the news. I might as well give myself this deadline almost. And I made a spreadsheet and I had all these contacts that I wanted to reach out to. And I said, I'm going to give this a shot. If after 6 months it doesn't work out, then I have a great career in product management and in technology that I can fall back on. Right. And then I came across this role at Cheddar. It was actually the first place I did a screen test for, the first place I interviewed in the news. And I was lucky enough to get it because they're very open to people with different backgrounds. So they liked the fact that I worked in tech and finance, didn't come from traditional broadcast, don't have a journalism background. Sure. So it kind of everything aligned at the right time, which was lovely for me.
I mean, it's amazing. I've been a fan of Cheddar. I think what I really love about Cheddar and is the fact that they have young people kind of speaking the language in a sense that it's not like watching Lester Holt. Nothing against Lester Holt. I love Lester Holt. He's very nice guy. But it's very different when you see someone of your generation come speaking to you, you know, and kind of speaking your language in a way you're just like, oh, okay, that makes sense. That makes total sense, you know.
That's the idea for Cheddar is we're not as focused. So when it was first launched, it was kind of compared to the CNBC for millennials, for example. Yeah. So we're a little bit less focused on breaking news, having to be the first one to report something, and more about, okay, let's take a step back, provide our own point of view from that young perspective, and just have a discussion with our co-anchors. So we're very encouraged to have an opinion, form a point of view, as long as it's backed up by evidence. We're not, shouting crazy things out of nowhere.
You're not Rudy Giuliani.
We're not Rudy Giuliani.
What happened to that guy?
We don't have hair dye running down the side of our faces.
Okay, Nora. I hope. Wow. Talk about it. Those were two meltdowns happening at the same time. Emotional meltdown and a dye meltdown.
Exactly. And it's so fun to be able, that's the kind of thing we can talk about on Cheddar. We're covering politics, we're covering business news and tech, but we might do a cute little roundup of the weird things that happened on the podium in the politics world sort of thing.
For sure.
Try to add that stuff in.
I feel like what I really like about Cheddar is that it always feels very relatable. It always feels very easy. It's like digestible news. It's not wait, what's happening now? when you watch MSNBC or CNBC, that's like, okay, those are too many big words and too many big numbers you're throwing at me. Like, what? And I feel like to me, Cheddar makes it in like digestible pieces, small pieces, but also fun and like we'll keep it light and it doesn't feel like you're doing freaking PhD. You're just like, oh, I'm just listening to, digestible news.
Yeah. Well, thank you for recognizing that. That's one of the things that drew me to Cheddar was I feel like in a lot of business coverage, there's some general assumptions that are made about the level of knowledge that the viewer has about business news.
Yes.
Like you talk about EPS and revenue and using other acronyms. It's like, well, if you've grown up in the business world or if you took an econ class, then yeah, you know that EPS stands for earnings per share, but we might as well just say it, instead of just saying EPS was a beat, say the earnings per share. And it's just, you take that extra step to just make it like you're talking to a family member about it versus like, I know this so well that I don't even have to explain what it means. Like, I hate when people talk like, it's like when you're trying to prove that you know something better than everyone
talking
else.
Over. It almost feels like you're like talking over someone, right?
Right,
You're just like, I'm tuning in.
Yeah, exactly.
Make it easy for me. Like, I'm tuning in. I don't want to think much. Like, listen, I write jokes. To be specific, I write dick jokes. Let me just be very specific. That's where my head's at. It's too much for me. It's too much.
Gotcha.
It's just too much. Nora, I think what fascinates me about your family and your background is that I don't think I've ever come across a South Asian family, especially of daughters, that are like classical pianists and classical violinists and went to Harvard and now are, you know, an anchor, you know, on a successful network like Cheddar. Walk me through, like, what was it like growing up in your household? I mean, it sounds like your parents had pretty kind of high standards for themselves. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were both scientists, but also for their daughters. I mean,
yeah.
Do you guys have a lot of tradition you grew up with, like traditional expectations, or were you guys like, no, we're gonna just treat you as just kids? Like, you're not a girl, you're not a boy, you're just kids.
Yeah, great, great question. So, I mean, growing up, there was obviously a lot of that push and pull between your own culture and being that diligent child of immigrants, but also wanting to fit in. I grew up in Minnesota,
sure.
Very white, you know, neighborhood sure. and school system. So my parents were always very focused, schoolwork first. It was like schoolwork and music were like this, like music was just short of the highest priority. And as I mentioned, we competed a lot and we're always practicing. But my parents made sure to allow us to do westernized, fun things in some ways more so than other South Asian families around me.
Yeah.
So, for example, we were allowed to go to prom. Some of my, you know, cousins and other South Asian friends weren't allowed to go to dances.
Would date or by yourself?
Well, with friends. My mom has never used the word date, I think, in her life. You know, it's like you have a special friend until you're married.
You have basically a special friend, yes.
Yeah, so there would be like a boy who came over to my house and like we went together, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I think what really drove myself and my sisters was just the support that we had for each other, because we used to perform together. We would compete together. My older sister is quite literally the smartest person that I know. So her academic success drove me. My little sister is the best musician among us. So that drove me. So yeah, it was just like this healthy amount of collective ambition, but also allowing us to live our lives and see friends and even have sleepovers every so often, which was a shock when my mom would allow me to do that.
But sleepovers of like boys or girls?
No. Oh no, just female friends in like elementary school, like for birthdays. Yeah. No boys ever slept over in my house.
No boys ever slept over.
No.
Were you kind of expected to live with your parents until you got married and then like moved out in your own place, or that wasn't a thing for your family? They were just like, do what you need to do.
Yeah, it was always education first. So when you get into college, like you are independent, do your own thing. And then immediately after college, we all moved, you know, had our own jobs, moved to different cities. So it was always the expectation.
Yeah.
You do your thing. We support you.
Yeah.
Like kind of like keep us posted on what's going on career-wise, especially.
I mean, that must be so interesting, you know. I mean, you guys are an only South Asian family in Minnesota. I mean, I don't know. Did they have anybody? I mean, Prince is the only black dude in Minnesota, and then the Ali family. Like, that's it.
You know, there's pockets of a lot of diversity in Minnesota. There's a big Somali community, big Hmong community. And a bunch of there were a lot of Bangladeshis. And by a lot, I mean there were a bunch, and we knew them all. You know, it's like we had a nice community of them. But yeah. It's only recently have I reflected on how different I was compared to my peers in school, but how much I actually did appreciate it, and they appreciated my culture. There was, you know, there was like culture day or ancestry day or whatever in school, and all my friends would be so excited for like my table, like the Bangladesh table. They'd want to put on like lehengas and eat the food and put the thing on their forehead, like to try to look as brown as possible. And we would have like Bollywood photo shoots in my house. So there was this big embrace of my culture. And sure. I feel like I took it for granted at the time, because I don't think everyone has that great experience that I did of people around me accepting my differences almost.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you grew up in Minnesota, and then how do you end up in LA because of, you know, are you,
I'm in New York.
Sorry, that's mm-hmm. right. How did you end up in New York because of Cheddar?
So I, after I graduated college, my first job was in New York. I worked at Goldman Sachs.
I think everybody lives in LA, Nora. So sorry.
Okay. All right. To me, everyone lives in New York. Like New York is the center of my universe.
I'm a New Yorker. So I've been here like 10 years. So I used to think everybody lives in New York.
Yeah, now there you go.
In LA.
Yeah. So I my first job out of college was in New York, like not even far from where I work now and where I live. And I had always wanted to live in New York City. It was like the dream. You're a Minnesotan in the Minnesota suburbs. It's like the big city with the big lights. Yeah. And I remember when I first told all my Minnesota high school friends, I'm moving to New York. There was this sense of like, oh, cool. It's New York. That's amazing. And I don't think I will ever leave. Yeah. I think it's the greatest city on earth. And I say that now.
Oh,
shit.
Oh God. I'm so sorry. My allergies. Oh, goodness.
Do you not agree? Like, so you've lived it on both coasts. Which do you prefer?
LA.
Why?
Lifestyle is just so much easier in the sense that we're not like on top of each other. Everything's not like a gajillion dollars. Don't get me wrong. LA is expensive, but not nearly as expensive as New York City.
Okay, I understand.
I can drive to, I can go to Big Bear on the same day and I snowboard and then be down at the beach on the same day.
Okay, that does sound very nice. I feel like I don't know what I'm missing with LA. I haven't really even been to LA, I don't think.
I said you need to make a trip, girl.
I will. In a post-COVID world, I will certainly go to LA. I feel like LA is the only other place I would go and live if my career took me there. It's like either New York or LA. Anywhere else, no thank you. And I will never end up back in Minnesota. I love it with all my heart. I love visiting my family, but it is not the place for me.
Sure. Because you've grown as a person, right? You've seen better things. You're just like, my vibe is not a Minnesota vibe. Is that a thing in Minnesota? I mean, I think it must be different for you than it is for me. I mean, when I was, I'm an immigrant. I'm not even first generation, right? I moved from when I was 15. So, I mean, for us, when we went to inner city high schools, you know, we were the only like South Asian or Desi kids there. I guess it sounds like that wasn't the case for you. You had a pretty multicultural school.
The school itself wasn't that multicultural, but there was this nice embrace of my culture. I feel like there was just a sense of like, oh, I'm interested in Bangladeshi culture. I'm interested in like eating the food that Nora's mom cooks. And I do still remember though being it kind of embarrassed when I would have to bring like lunch to school. A lot of immigrants and immigrant children have this experience. It's like traumatizing.
I know exactly why, Nora.
Right? Right? It's like I remember very clearly there was, oh my gosh, this is terrible. I tweeted about this recently. My mom had made these wonderful like noodles that had onions and a lot of spices and it was like delicious. We had it the night before for dinner. And she was like, why don't you take some leftovers for lunch tomorrow? And I was like, okay. Because I never want to disrespect my mom, especially when it comes to food. So I remember bringing it in the lunchbox. It came lunchtime. I was too embarrassed to take it out during lunch because I knew it was going to smell so strongly. It's like onions and spices, and it's noodles, and it's been sitting in my lunchbox.
Say no more.
No. So I didn't eat it. But then I was embarrassed to bring it home and like admit to my mom that I didn't eat it. So it just sat under my desk for like, I think, weeks and like rotted and molded. I don't remember what I ended up doing with it, but I just remember every day when I would go to school and see my lunchbox, I would just feel this tremendous guilt because I didn't eat my mom's food because I was embarrassed around my friends. But now all I do is cook Bengali food. All I do is bring Bengali food with me wherever I go and cook it for my friends. So it's like this mental shift.
You know what it is also, Nora? I think as U.S. culture has also evolved, they've also become more embracing of diversity and diverse, you know, embracing of minority cultures. Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, for me, I used to be so ashamed of making desi food at home. and not smelling like it in high school, because it was only like maybe 5 South Asian kids, and we went to an inner city high school, so it was predominantly black and Latino kids. Mm-hmm, and you know, and regardless of what ethnicity the children are, they're fucking mean. Kids are mean.
Kids are mean, yes.
They're fucking assholes. You know, and
yep.
I remember going to high school and kids like bullying me and be like, "You smell like curry. Oh, you're disgusting. What are you, Indian?" I was like, "Fuck you. We're Pakistani, but we eat curry too." You know, you're just like, "Ah, this sucks," you know, and you're just trying to blend in this kind of shame of like being like people make you feel shame for your culture. And I think I think now as we've evolved more and people where now you see it more of brown faces like yourself and myself and like on social media and in the media more, and I think people have been like, "Oh, okay, people that are here that have the
exactly
know, food has become a popular food of cuisine that people like and enjoy, and it's like, oh, I love smelling like curry. It's like
it's like a badge of honor now.
Growing up I could never say, "Oh my god, I love smelling like curry," you know, because that was a badge of shame, you know.
Right. And all you want to do as a kid is like eat what everyone else is eating.
That's right.
On top of being embarrassed by bringing Bengali food to school, I also have very severe allergies. So I'm allergic to all nuts. So PB&J, all the little kids would just always be eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, eating Snickers bars. And I was like, I wish I could just eat a PB&J. I was embarrassed to even tell my classmates that I was allergic. I remember one time this kid brought Snickers bars for his birthday, like his birthday treat. I didn't want to tell anyone I couldn't eat it. So I ate a bite of a Snickers bar that has peanuts in it. I threw up on the ground in school. This is like first grade. My mom had to come pick me up. I was too embarrassed to tell my mom that I ate a peanut, because she'd be like, "Why did you eat the peanut?" So I just told her I had a stomach ache and then went home with her. It was just terrible. But back to the smelling like curry thing. Because I've noticed now in this, you know, pandemic world where we're distanced from our coworkers and our friends, I am much less self-conscious about my hair smelling like cumin. With my co-anchors, usually we sit next to each other. So if I would cook the night before, I'd make sure I wash my hair that night or the next morning, because we're just together for like hours at the same desk. But now I don't go near anybody. I'm in the studio, but I'm alone in the studio. So I'm like, spray the cumin in my hair. I don't even care.
You're like rubbing it on yourself. Yeah,
exactly.
That's what I like to do with kimchi, because I think I must have been Korean in my past life, because anything to do with Korean culture or food is like, I'm all day.
Are you a K-pop fan?
Oh, I like certain K-pop, like BTS,
Blackpink.
I like those folks. BTS is all right, but Blackpink, BTS, I honestly, it's just like...
Is it too mainstream for you?
No, they're so pretty. They're so pretty.
They're so pretty.
And they're so delicate. And I'm like, "Oh, honey, is something going to break you?" It's so delicate. But they have millions of fans. Like, girls go crazy. I'm like,
I know.
I'm like, I don't know what they're singing. Does anybody know what they're singing? What are
they saying? They have more English songs now. Their song "Dynamite" is their first like fully English song, which I think is the bop of the summer for sure.
Is it the bop of the summer?
It came out towards the end of the summer, but yeah, did it even have summer,
Nora? What?
No, where did it go? I have no idea.
You know, I don't know. I mean, how have you been kind of dealing with this whole pandemic thing this year? I mean, did you have like big plans where you're just like, "Yeah, that went down the gutter," like, "Oh, that sucks"? Like,
yeah, you know, fortunately I didn't have huge like travel plans for this year. I'm so lucky that I went to Australia and New Zealand in January, before everything went down. My cousin got married in Australia, and then my parents and I just toured New Zealand for a week, a little bit over a week.
Yeah.
And I remember trying to decide if I wanted to do this trip with my parents, because usually when we travel, like, my sisters are there too. I've never gone on a trip with just my parents. I was trying to consider, like, what are we going to do? Are we going to have, you know, as much fun as we would as a whole family? But then I was like, you know what? I feel like I'm not going to get that much opportunity to travel with my parents. Little did I know there was going to be a pandemic when I wouldn't be able to see them for so long. Okay. So I feel like that lined up really nicely. And then I, you know, a couple friends' weddings. My cousin was supposed to get married this year, and that obviously didn't happen. So I'm very lucky in that my life didn't get upended too much. I'm going to knock on wood because you never know. But
listen, I think, you know, look, you're in the news world. I mean, you you get the most latest news that I don't even get, right? So you're listening to stuff. I mean, given with everything that's happening with the pandemic, then I mean, the numbers are skyrocketing, right? Yeah. Iowans are struggling. I mean, South Dakota is struggling. And, you know, there is no federal mandate that has been put in place because, as you know, the orange ape, thank God, who refuses to concede, he who shall not be named. Oh, no, I name him all the time. Fuck
we can call him Voldemort if you want.
We can totally call him Voldemort. He's awful. He's just awful. But I feel like what he's done, and if, because we don't have a federal mandate and it's state-to-state basis, I mean, that's why it's so out of control. I mean, you listen to the news every day. Like, kind of, what are your kind of thoughts on this?
Yeah, there's been such an over-reliance on local governments, to your point. To the point where, I don't know if you tuned into Andrew Cuomo as the governor of New York, his daily briefings early on in the pandemic, but, you know, we're a national news organization. We happen to be headquartered in New York, but every single day, the Cuomo briefing, we would take it live and show our viewers end to end what Andrew Cuomo had to say, because he was being real with the audience. There was a plan for New Yorkers, and there was just, he was, I think, the proxy for how things were going nationwide. And I know a lot of people turned to the local governments to give them a sense of what was going on. But that makes it difficult to crack down on the virus, because if you have a family member in Connecticut you're trying to visit, you're going across state borders. There's different rules there than there is in New York. And I was planning on traveling to Minnesota to see my family for Thanksgiving. Obviously, I canceled that. Yeah. But there's testing rules before you depart New York. There's testing rules when you land in Minnesota. There's testing rules for when you get back to New York, you have to have tested negative within 3 days prior to arriving. But it's very hard to get tests in Minnesota. So you're absolutely right. The fact that it's different everywhere has been the biggest challenge for sure.
I honestly feel come January 20th, which would be so amazing. I hope Trump shows up because I want to see his face. I want to see him just standing there, just writhing with anger. And he's holding a sign that says, I won, as Biden is being sworn. Oh,
I wouldn't be surprised. Honestly, I don't expect him to show up. That would take
I really hope he courage. Doesn't show up. Because you know? God knows, we know that Melania Trump's filing for divorce on January 19th. Right before the inauguration.
So I curious what that whole family does, definitely.
Laura, that family is, you know, it's that family. I don't know. You don't remember Adam's family? Where you were like, wow, that family's so weird.
Yeah.
They make the Adams family look like, you know, a bunch of like a bunch of Mormons. Like, holy shit.
I miss the Addams Family. That was a good show.
Addams Family is such a great show. But you know what? The great thing about the Addams Family was that there was love. Something that my family would never know. love is not what they do. But I just feel like I really hope, I don't know if Biden can federally mandate to be like, face masks are mandatory. I don't give a shit what state this is. This is mandatory face mask. You don't wear a face mask outside. You get a ticket. Distancing, all that stuff. But you know where it becomes challenging, Nora? And I don't know if this has been the case for Governor Cuomo in New York, but in California, we have Governor Newsom. Now, Governor Newsom, as much as I like him and I have liked him in the past, he is a hypocrite. And because what he's doing is he's like, everybody, wear a mask, no more gatherings, no singing, no caroling. Three families getting along together. Next thing you know, he's like out there with Nancy Pelosi, all these people getting together inside a restaurant, no masks, French Laundry. people found out, they were taking pictures, they were posting it. And it's just like, you can't do that in the middle of a fucking pandemic.
I think you've hit on one of the biggest conundrums of this pandemic is it's so easy to preach what should be done. And then you think as like an individual person, but it's okay if I go see my family, or it's okay if I go do this thing, if everyone else doesn't. And if everyone has that mindset, then you just have people, you know, traveling for Thanksgiving and people gathering with their three best friends from different households in the same place. And I think it's like, I wanted to do this, a deep dive into game theory and like the psychology behind people thinking that they can get away with it. But it's just, it blows my mind. There's no way to get everyone to comply because we're all at the end of the day, very egotistical, selfish people.
That's true. But Dora, you know, what also makes it really difficult is when your leaders don't follow the very rules.
Totally. They should be held to a higher standard. Absolutely.
And then you're like, I no longer have any respect for you because you lost credibility with me. You're not practicing what you preach.
Right.
So has Governor Cuomo been caught without a mask, getting together at parties? What's his deal?
Not that I'm aware of. He's been, you know, he shared a few social media pictures of him with his family. He famously talks about his daughter's boyfriend, and he's just really been with his family and not out and about. So that's good.
My dear friend James, who's a big fan, he says he may, he's talking about Trumpy. He may remember that George Bush 43 was heckled when he headed to the helicopter after the Obama inauguration. Trumpy hates being laughed at. And he goes, Trumpy will not be in Washington, D.C. on the 20th. I think there's a good chance he will be abroad by then. Yeah, he's probably going to be in Moscow with Moscow.
Well, he's promised that he's going to leave, or that he'll need to leave. So we'll see if that actually happens.
I really hope to. Listen, come January 20th, he's a regular citizen, and he's got that $421 million bill waiting for him. So
yes.
No matter how you cut that cake, he's got a bill to pay.
He does, yeah. It's going to be a weird transition for him.
Listen, he can't work on the gram enough to pay for that $421
million. Well, what if he's allegedly starting a news network, potentially. So that, really? That could be his next project. Yeah. It's been floated because he's becoming increasingly disappointed with Fox News because it, you know, called Arizona in favor of Biden early on.
Yeah. Terrible, Nora. Oh my God. And,
yeah. I mean, that's the thing with news now. It's becoming increasingly bifurcated because the notion of facts and truth is just so unfortunately nebulous right now.
Yes.
That people are choosing platforms that align with their viewpoints, and it's creating echo chambers. Newsmax is a relatively new platform. A lot of conservative voices go there. Same thing is happening on social media too. Have you heard of Parler?
Yes, I was just going to bring it up.
Yeah, so we actually had the CEO of Parler on our show recently, and they don't moderate content. They also don't leverage your data and monetize your data in the way that Facebook does. So that's been a draw for users to go to Parler. But then you end up having conversations with people who think like you.
Sure.
But that's what people want now. People don't really want to see the other side or have a discussion with the other side. So I think this is like a very pivotal, critical moment in how we just consume news and media generally.
I feel like the Trumpism has really kind of brought this level of divisiveness in a country that, you know, we've just never seen before. It's really unprecedented. And I feel like all these shenanigans about, you know, all these fake lawsuits that he's filing and, you know, just trying to create chaos and ruckus is just a way of him setting himself up to be like, I'm going to run for 2024. It's like, dude, once was enough. We saw what you did. Nobody's going to vote for you.
I don't know. I think people will, though, unfortunately. You know, there's still the rabid base that believes he was wronged. Our D.C. correspondent, J.D., who is, you know, doing a lot of great reporting on the ground in D.C. during the election, has talked to a lot of Trump supporters who truly believe the election was stolen from him and would be so jazzed to vote for him again in 2024. So yeah, it's hard to wrap your head around how people are still on his side, but people feel disenfranchised. They feel like the Black Lives Matter movement is taking away from their own rights, which is a remarkable thing to think, but those people exist.
I feel like what the Trumpism is, which is part of the Trump lifestyle, is that to do all the horrific things, mm-hmm. and when people call you out on it, you gaslight it, and you turn around and you say, no, you're doing it, and then, like, I'm the victim of it.
cancel culture. That's what happens. It's like you say you're the victim because you've gotten canceled after having said something super racist or homophobic. Sure. You, like, make yourself into the victim, and that's happened so much. That's right. Yeah, you're right. Gaslighting is, like, the word of the year, I feel. That's just so accurate for what's happening generally.
Honestly, Nora, I don't ever want to hear somebody tell me they don't know what a narcissist looks like. It's like, stop it. Stop it. The world has gotten a really, really fantastic idea of what a narcissist and a sociopath looks like.
Totally.
Who loves to gaslight.
Yeah.
Trump and all his cronies.
Definitely. And just the inability to admit wrong, even if, like, the science, the guidance from the CDC, WHO, et cetera, has changed, of course, over the course of the pandemic, because we have different information.
Sure.
And scientists can say that. They can say the data has changed, the information has changed. Sure. This is what we recommend now, which might be different than what we recommended early on. But, like, Trump has never done that. He's never like, oh, you know what? Actually, this is the case now. I was wrong before, but this is what the evidence tells me now. It's like, oh, I was always right.
Right.
Or like blaming someone else. You know, it's just a lot of pointing fingers.
I don't take responsibility. It's not my fault. It's China.
Or like that's what the scientists said, or you know, whatever.
Listen, you know what fascinates me is that his nepotism Barbie, as I like to call her, Ivanka Trump, you know, he took her, first of all, she occupies the first lady's office, which is alarming because you're just like, you're not the first lady. We know that your daddy's trying to bang you, but please stop. What fascinates me is that they went to China and she got 17 patents approved.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. Like an expedited path to getting patents approved. Yeah, exactly.
So I think what fascinates me is that then he comes back and he's like, China didn't do this and China didn't do that. So I wonder, did the leader of China, what's his name?
Xi Jinping.
Yeah. Did him and Trump were just like, hey, I'm going to give you the patents, okay? I'm going to talk shit about you like we totally hate each other, but we, like, totally love each other. And it's like, we're like, all these exotic animals, let's do this. We're totally going to be like, okay, pinky promise. Okay, I'm going to go bang, and I'm going to, like, talk smack about you, but I'm like, we're friends. And then you're going to give me just a bunch of patents into my daughter/chick I want to bang. And then it's going to be fine, right? We're going to do that. And I wonder if a conversation like that went down between Xi Jinping and Trump when he went to China.
Under the table agreements?
Yes.
Listen, I don't know. It's possible. The whole China-U.S. trade relationship, you know what I'm trying to say, has been one of the biggest market stories, business stories, but that was pre-pandemic. Every single day, almost every day, there's a new tweet from President Trump about tariffs or his viewpoint on intellectual property theft from China, and that would move markets in one way or another. Sure. But almost out of nowhere, it just dropped out of our dialogue because of the pandemic. So I do think that when things wind down, with the pandemic, hopefully soon, that's going to be back in the conversation because it's so critical to our everyday, but it's going to be vastly different because we won't have tweets from President Trump, and Joe Biden is going to be negotiating with Xi Jinping. So I have no clue what these under the table discussions might have been between Trump and Xi Jinping.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes I was watching you on Cheddar Network, and I think as an anchor, do you also kind of get to bring in your kind of opinion about the news and about the stories, or is it kind of sticking to the script and just kind of getting the facts out?
We do bring in our informed opinions, especially when we talk about business and finance news. Sure. Because it's easier to say, you know what, I see a lot of value in Disney reorganizing its teams and having two separate teams to talk about distribution, another team to talk about content, because that's like a smart business decision. We can say stuff like that. We can use adjectives. But when it comes to politics news, we've been trying to just stay pretty objective. And by objective, I mean, if Trump does something psychotic, like, we will say that this is crazy. What he's saying is lies. We will objectively say that. We're not trying to play both sides. Sure. But we do try to report factually, objectively, for politics especially, and really rely on our politics guests. We have lawmakers on and rely on them to bring that additional insight. Yeah. But yeah, we are encouraged to have our own opinions and point of views and healthy discussions among our co-anchors, which I like.
I mean, when you had auditioned for this role, your anchor role on Cheddar, was that something that was like part of the audition where they were like, okay, we're going to give you a piece of news and then be like, tell us your opinion?
It wasn't. And that's a great question. I think maybe that's, they got insight into that during my interviews one-on-one with the managers and the bosses. Cause we did have discussions on business news. Like one of the topics that came up was the Apple HomePod had just come out. I don't know anyone who owns, do you know about the Apple HomePod? It's Apple's smart home device. So it's its version of Google Home or an Alexa. So it had just come out. And for some reason, I was adamant that this was like the next big thing for Apple. Like, no, seriously, people are making fun of it now, but I'm telling you, people are going to have HomePods. And I like had this debate with, I think, our VP of content. I mean, I was wrong. No one I know has a HomePod, but it was a nice, healthy discussion. I had my own evidence, and I think that's probably where they got that sense.
Yeah.
But then you just learn how to do it in real time. Like, you're thrown into the anchor desk. My first day on the job, they were just like, you're doing this two-hour show. I was like, which camera? Like, I didn't even know how, like, camera work works or even teleprompt or anything like that. Sure. So you just kind of got to learn as you go, I guess.
I mean, you know, I feel like, is that, what is kind of your, do you like kind of see a life where you're just going to be an anchor for the rest of your life, probably move on to a bigger, you know, another network eventually, or maybe start your own network, like Trump, or, you know, like this is the brown network, what's kind of your kind of future endeavors that you're looking at?
Yeah, good question. I have this existential debate with myself like every day. It's hard to think about the future in that I just feel very lucky to have a job right now. Sure. And to have a job where I have a lot of autonomy and freedom to pitch stories that I'm interested in, offer up my opinion. Sure. And it's very fun, as I'm sure you've noticed. We're like kind of wacky sometimes.
Yeah.
I get to talk about my passion for Marvel superheroes and Star Wars. By the way, that's from The Mandalorian. I don't know if you can see this guy. It's like my little figurine.
I was looking at that, actually. I'm like obsessed with The Mandalorian.
You are?
Obsessed.
Oh my gosh. I have a baby Yoda as well. He's too far away, but I don't even know where he is
right
now.
My heart can't take it. It's like back ordered to like 2021.
Baby Yodas?
Yeah. My brother told me that. He's like, I try to order a Baby Yoda, dude, and I can't order it. I'm like, why? What happened? He's like, it's like back order till 2021.
Oh, I got gifted my Baby Yoda. It's just like, it's like known at the company that I'm
not
the Baby
as fancy
Yoda
as you, Nora. I'm not an anchor at Cheddar. Like, I don't get Baby Yodas like that, Nora.
I'll send you a Baby Yoda. I'll see if I can find one.
Baby Yoda.
So much of my content has Baby Yoda. Anyway, to answer your question, I love what I do day to day, but it's funny that you said you made a joke about a brown network. Like, that's totally something that's floated in my head before. It's like a news channel about South Asian news for South Asians. Have you seen The Juggernaut before? It's a South Asian publication. So I'm obsessed with The Juggernaut.
Yeah.
We've had the founder, Snigdha Sir, on Cheddar before.
Yeah.
And it's like just amazing content that you can't get anywhere else about South Asian things. Like today I retweeted an article about the best biryanis to serve at Thanksgiving. And I was like, oh my gosh, my mom just,
what?
Yeah, my mom asked me a couple weeks ago, she's like, do you want biryani on Thanksgiving? And we laughed together. I was like, yeah, of course, I always want biryani, mom. And I didn't think this was like a thing other people thought about, was biryani on Thanksgiving. So sadly, I won't be able to go home and I won't get any biryani, but still. Anyway, so yeah, I feel like those are the kinds of stories that I would love to tell, whether it's on its own Brown Network or doing it through Cheddar. And the beauty of Cheddar is, if I was like, you know what, I want to do this story on biryani at Thanksgiving, they would say, absolutely, you can do a deep dive and talk about it. So
I love that.
Yeah, it's great. They're very open to really anything.
I just love, I think, and also just kind of seeing like these kind of diverse voices. You know what's interesting is that a lot of the bigger networks, there's a very big conversation about representation. There's a big conversation about diversity, and I think what fascinates me is that there's still a lot of networks that are just doing lip service, right? They're like, oh my god, no, I'm totally about diversity. And then you look at their writing room and it's all like straight white dudes. You're like, what, you just said that you were big on diversity? Like, what happened? All your producers and all your executives are just like all white dudes. Like,
yeah, unfortunately, that's a real reality in this industry. And thankfully, the renewed conversations around racial injustice have, I think, for the first time in my lifetime, definitely the first time in my lifetime, it's like a true internal look at where we need to improve on diversity, and not just to say like, oh, we did the thing. But to truly figure out what's wrong with the system where you do end up with mostly white people at the top. Right. So I'm optimistic, cautiously optimistic, that companies are finally looking internally now.
I mean, look, I don't have anything against all white dudes or just white dudes, period. Right? I don't have any beef against them. Unless they're shooting up a school, then I have a problem. But, you know, I don't have a problem with white guys. That's not what my problem is. I think what I'm really referring to is the decision-making process is really what I'm referring to, right? Yeah. Look, there are a lot of white dudes who are straight up allies, man. Mm. And we need those allies. And as they would be allies to us, we are also allies to them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I feel like it's a thing that goes both ways. It's a symbiosis in many, many ways. So, I think a Brown Network thing would be cool. I think, I don't know if this happens for you, and this is like me being brutally honest. I think for me, sometimes what happens is Juggernaut is really good, but some of the other stuff that I've seen where they try to do just South Asian stuff, it just kind of gets this in a strange place where it's like they're recycling the same people, talking about the same things, where it's just like, but there's an evolution happening, not just for South Asians in the West, and I don't mean the U.S., I mean in Europe, in Australia, all, you know, but there's also a big evolution happening in the Middle East. There's also a big evolution happening in South Asia itself, you know, and I feel like there hasn't, I think the news that goes out in South Asia, in the Middle East, is so much different than the news that comes out of the West, right?
Yeah, very true. I wonder if there is some way, and I have thought about this, like, is there a way to bridge those two worlds where we have insight into what's going on the ground there, the kind of news that they get on the ground, but for a westernized audience, and even the other way around is how do you get news about what's going on in the U.S. that is catered to that audience? I don't really know if anyone's done it that well. Obviously, you have international news networks like Al Jazeera or BBC. But yeah,
that's a state-run network, so let's not forget about that part.
Yeah. Well, that's true. So, I think especially when you're pitching stories, and this is my experience at Cheddar, is you're automatically going to be drawn to the stories that are about people like you. I love pitching South Asian stories and pitching South Asian guests.
Sure.
So I do understand the limitations. You can be the best ally. You can be the best white person ally on the planet. Yes. But there are limitations to what you are exposed to the ideas that you have, the drive that you have to tell diverse stories in some cases. So yeah, I think there is just so much value in bringing different voices because of the motivations that those people have to tell particular stories.
Yeah. I mean, Nora, I mean, you're born and raised here. When you go to Bangladesh, which I don't know how often you guys go, what is that like? Like, where you as kids went to Dhaka? I guess that's where you guys were born, I would think. And like, you go there. I mean, how are you kind of perceived? Are your relatives like how, why are these girls aren't married yet? Why are they living like this traditional lifestyle? And your parents are like, whoa, take a deep breath. These are our kids, relax.
Yeah. So the last time I went to Bangladesh was in 2008.
Oh, wow.
2007 or 8. It's been a while. It's been a hot second. I'm like looking at my computer to check what year it is. No, to check what year it is. I'm like, oh yeah, it's 2020. So it was a while ago. I love it. I have family there still. It's really fun. Yeah. But my sisters and I, and this is going back to kind of like our upbringing and that tension between Western and Bengali culture, we were never forced to speak Bengali to our parents. They never enforced that. So they would speak to us in Bengali. Kind of a mix of Bengali and English. My mom, mostly Bengali, and we would respond in English.
Yeah.
But my cousins, I think every one of my like 25 first cousins were required to speak Bengali to their parents, to my aunts and uncles. So my sisters and I, for some reason, are just this like group of three girls among the cousins who don't speak Bengali well. Yeah. I speak it terribly, like terribly. I understand it fully, but I sound like like a Minnesotan white girl when I speak Bengali, unfortunately. So when I go to Bangladesh, there is a sense of disappointment and inability to communicate because I'm responding in like very broken Bengali and mostly English. Sure. But there are questions about why aren't you married? And I mean, last time I was there, I was still like 18 or 19, but even now my Bengali communities in the US, it is a big question. It's like, oh, my older sister's married, my little sister's married. I'm the only one who isn't. So they're like, Nora, what's wrong with you? But my parents have been very
kind. Nothing is wrong with you, Nora. Your life is what you're doing.
Exactly. But my parents don't bother me about it, which is nice.
That's wonderful. Yeah. That's so wonderful. You know, Nora, I look at people like Jamila Jamil, killing, you know, and they're awesome at what they do. You know, Mindy especially. I mean, she's extraordinary at what she does. She really is. She's just really wonderful at what she does.
I love her, yeah.
Yeah, she's pretty great. And I look at that, you know, and one of the things that always kind of jumps out at me, and I don't know if you feel the same way about this, is that there is this sense of there's never a real conversation about the plight and the issues that plague South Asian women in our culture here and abroad. There's somehow there is this level of shyness. There is this level of avoidance. Like, you know, like things are good for me, so I don't need to talk about things that are actually taking place for other women in my life. You know what I'm saying? There's this level of like detachment. This is nothing against Jamila Jamil, but the first time I heard her take on, you know, the diet pill industry, and she's very big on that.
Right.
And I was just like, really? That's, you want to take that? You want to take that?
Like, that's the hill you want to die on kind of thing?
That's the hill you want to die on? Like, you know that our women face a huge plight of what they're experiencing, not just in their native country, but even abroad. I mean, I personally, you know, I get invited to do shows kind of all over the place. And I remember doing a show in the Bay Area, and these are very well-off South Asians, you know, Pakistanis and Indian Bangladeshis. I have like these women walking up to me and telling me how they're victims of domestic violence, how they survive so much abuse. And you know, I talk about this all the time, and I'm sure some of my viewers kind of get sick of me talking about it, but I talk about it because it's important. I come from a very domestically violent household.
And
for me, it's something that I kind of look at, and I'm just like, y'all just gonna skip over that?
You
don't think that's like a real problem of how much misogyny exists in our culture.
Sure. Right.
Here and abroad. Even the American-born kids, most, I'm going to talk about guys, even they have so much of that. Not all of them, but you definitely see it. I definitely see it, you know?
Right.
And I think that's the kind of thing that I kind of look at and I'm just like, wow, that's never discussed. That's never even talked about. It's just kind of glanced over. And it's a glaring problem. It's a glaring issue.
Yeah. I mean, now that I think of it, the high profile South Asians that I know of don't necessarily spend their energies highlighting specific issues for those communities. And I'm just thinking off the top of my head. Yeah. But I do wonder, is that the case just for the South Asian community, or is that just this like conflict of people from other countries, immigrants, children of immigrants in the U.S. who feel like the issues that they want to project or they want to talk about are ones that relate to a wider audience, maybe. Like, I feel like I can make the most impact if I'm for Jamila Jamil talking about, you know, body image issues, that sort of thing, because it's relatable. I feel like I can have an impact on a wide audience and not just alienate others. That's a very good point. I hadn't thought of that. I'm going to do some digging and see if there's South Asians who are championing those specific issues you brought up.
Yeah. I mean, I personally haven't seen it yet. I mean, besides myself, I haven't really seen a lot of people kind of out there being very verbal about it or talking about it. Maybe because maybe for some people there's a shame aspect maybe there's attached to it. I mean, look, it took me almost like 10 years to kind of overcome my shame and my kind of fears and my stuff to be like, all right, I'm like ready to talk about it on stage, right? And I think putting it in a comedic kind of setting is a fine line. It's a fine line to walk. It's just like you want to honor the victims and you want to honor what's happening, but you also want to kind of make it lighthearted to be like, this is some real shit that goes down. Like,
does it help you process if you talk about it in a comedic setting and have other people react to it?
Absolutely. It's very therapeutic. You know, it's very therapeutic. And I think the first time I did it, I was like terrified. I was just terrified. I was like, oh my God, how are people going to see me? How are they going to judge me? This is going to be horrible. People are going to see me as a victim. I don't want to be seen as a victim. I'm not a victim. I'm somebody who rose above it and managed to do great things with their life. I remember doing it the first time and getting off stage and having at least like five people approach me with their own stories. They're like, I'm not there where you are emotionally, but this is what happened to me.
Right.
And, oh my God, thank you so much for doing this. Or thank you for talking about it because now I feel encouraged to talk about my stories.
Yeah. Do you find when you have nervousness in talking about those subjects, you're nervous about what the audience or quote unquote strangers are going to think or what your family is going to think, like your relatives?
I think I'm over the family thing. I really don't care, quite frankly. I just don't. Mainly because they're the ones who caused the problems. I just kind of don't care at this point. I think for me, it's about how people will look at me. You know, it's just like the perception of just being not being like looked down at or not being looked at as like, you know, as you're like,
ah. Right. Well, what I admire about you is like you talk about R-rated content. You make jokes that you don't hear other South Asian people make. And for me, I do find myself not saying everything that's on my mind sometimes when I'm on air because I'm like, okay, like if my mom's watching.
Exactly.
I don't want her to know that I did so and so. Like, I'm not even saying it out loud now in case she like comes across this on YouTube one day. But that is still the biggest driving factor for me, I think, in life is parental approval. And I have talked to my therapist about it. I'm working through it, but it's still there.
Okay. First of all, kudos to you for going to therapy and talking.
Yes. Good therapy is the greatest decision I've ever made in my entire life.
Really? Can I ask, not if you don't want to, of course, talk about it, but what made you kind of be like, I should go to therapy? And how long have you been in therapy for?
Yeah, so it started, I feel like, a couple of years ago. It started with my boyfriend at the time, now ex-boyfriend. But we had decided that we wanted to go to to couples therapy, I guess. So it started with that. And my therapist realized quickly that I had a lot more to unpack than he did. So she said, Nora, we're going to just do one-on-one sessions, like you and me. And then I went every week since then. And she helped me through this breakup, which I somehow did without losing it. It was a very calm, collected, rational process. I moved into my own apartment. It's a challenge when you're going through a breakup and you have to be on air and like happy all the time.
Yes.
So it was good to have a therapist to help me through that. And it's really just been upkeep at this point. She has taught me the tools to evaluate my own feelings, to take a step back and ask myself why I'm feeling a certain way. Yeah. And it's truly, truly changed who I am. So anyone watching, I highly recommend therapy for everybody.
Yay. Good job. That's amazing, Nora. Yeah. No, I'm a huge, huge therapy and mental health advocate. I will highly recommend it to people. I've been in therapy for 13 years.
Nice.
13, 14 years. Yeah. Yeah. I'm a big, big fan of therapy. Yeah. Huge advocate. I know, Nora. By the way, does your family know you go to therapy?
Yeah, I did tell, great question, because it's the kind of thing you don't really talk about, in my family at least. I told my mom because I had to, she's now coming around to the idea of therapy. I think it's just so much less taboo generally. Mm-hmm. But I explained it to her when I had to tell her that my boyfriend and I had broken up because she thought we were going to get married.
Yeah.
And I had to explain to her, mom, we went to therapy. I went to therapy. We came to this conclusion. It's not an irrational decision we're making. And she was happy. She was proud of me. She's like, all right, well, it seems like you're happy. You made an informed decision. What I would love is to have my mom go to therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's some resistance there because she knows best.
Listen, I think you know and I know that, from the kind of backgrounds we come from, you're only two things. You're either normal or crazy, and crazy people go to therapy.
Right. I know, and that's the connotation, unfortunately, but I do really think in the last couple of years, therapy has become so commonplace now.
Yes.
Where it's like if you don't go to therapy, if there's someone in my age group who has never been to therapy, I'm like, really? It's more of a surprise now if you haven't even tried it.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm assuming you're the first person in your family to go to therapy.
My little sister has gone to therapy. She's the most mature human in our whole family. So that just makes sense. And she's very proactive about her emotions. And she's the one to moderate arguments when they happen. She's amazing. If you can't tell, my sisters, I admire them more than anyone on the entire planet.
I see. There's a lot of love in your family. Yes. It's nice to see that.
There's the three of us. I don't know if you can see
that. I see that. It's adorable.
And that's my niece, my little sisters.
I saw a performance of all of you. I forget. Is it Carnegie Hall you guys are performing at? Where are you guys? It was
It was the one that you probably saw was somewhere in Alabama, but my little sister has performed in Carnegie Hall.
Oh, sure. It was 9 years ago. It's all three of you are performing. And I was oh my God, this family is so overachieving. out there, dude.
My mom I know exactly what video you're talking about. And my mom likes to send that to all her friends. And strangers.
It was so cute. You're sitting there and this, so I think, were you playing the violin? Who was playing the violin?
I started on the violin and then we swapped.
Got it. You swapped with the and then
you then on the piano.
I mean, do you and your sister who goes to therapy, do you guys kind of talk about your stuff? Do you feel without getting too personal about this, do you guys talk about or maybe exchange information about, since you guys grew up in the same household, about the way you guys were raised, and that just kind of brought up issues as you became adults? And of course, the issues really get magnified when you get into a relationship with someone. You're just oh, that's how I think. And that's what comes for me. Oh my God, I did not know that I was carrying this crazy baggage of stuff that I didn't know that was existing, because relationships really kind of push you, good relationships anyway,
totally.
kind of throwing that out. Do you feel like you and your sister kind of had like similar kind of stuff? Mm-hmm.
A great question. We have both identified that our relationship, you know, with our mom and the way that we grew up and our interactions with her really shaped who we are and how we think about things. So we've definitely talked about that. But yeah. I think where we talk the most about our mental health is like, help me deal with the situation that I'm going through with mom or other family members. Cause we know how the other one reacts to situations. We know each other's emotional spectrum. Mm-hmm. So we don't necessarily talk about like, oh, my takeaways from therapy were X, Y, Z. But it's like helping each other navigate situations because we did grow up with the same mother. And I do it with both my sisters. Because they have very different perspectives. They're only 6 years apart, but they had like vastly different experiences growing up. And here I was stuck in the middle.
Well, you're the middle child. So you're also the peacemaker, right?
Yeah, you're right. That is me. Also the troublemaker, actually.
Also a little bit of the troublemaker, but mostly middle children usually are the most reliable ones, the ones that you can depend on, peacemakers.
Yes.
Let's smooth it out. Let's talk. Everybody, everybody talk. And, you know. Uh-huh.
That's absolutely right. And I'm the one who's like visiting all my family members.
Yeah, of course you are.
I try to see everyone the most.
Of course you are. You're the middle child. That's the textbook middle child syndrome. Yeah, I'm the youngest and the only girl in the family after four boys.
Oh my gosh, what was that like?
Painful. Too much. It's too.
Oh my gosh. I always wanted a brother. I'm a little jealous. No?
You're not missing out, Nora.
Okay.
I think you got lucky. You got sisters.
Sisters are, they're the best. My sister, older sister, has two girls, so two sisters. One of them is named Nora. Named after me, which is so sweet. So we're just like a very girl forward family.
Yeah, absolutely. No, our family was very, very testosterone driven, very masculine. There's not feminine energy is not welcomed. Feminine energy is not really embraced. Even as a woman, I think the only person who was really allowed to be very feminine was my mom.
Huh.
You know,
but not you.
Not me. Wearing the bangles and getting her nails, you know, and wearing the henna and all that. And I was just a straight up tomboy, just beating up kids in school and shit. Like,
oh, no.
Getting in trouble and getting called in the principal's office. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, I was like, I was a bit of a hellraiser, you know, as a kid.
What's the worst thing you did in school?
I did a few. This is in Pakistan. I had this. So we used to have like these tables that have four chairs in them.
Uh huh.
You know, like desk, like you share.
Yeah.
I remember a friend of mine who was sitting next to me. She got up to go talk to the teacher, and she came back. And I thought it would be hilarious if I pull her chair and watch her tumble down.
Oh no.
I pulled the chair, she went tumbling down, and she's like, why did you do that? And I was like, I thought it would be hilarious. And she's like, you're an asshole. I'm like,
oh my gosh.
I think you're right, I am an asshole.
Was it because like your brothers would prank you and that's how you, okay, so you wanted to dish it out on take it out on someone else.
Exactly. You know, I would get pulled in my principal's office. My principal's like, I don't get it. You're a good student. You get all these good grades. I don't get why you do this. I don't understand. And my mom would show up to school and she's like, I have four boys. And when you get daughter gets in trouble. Every time.
Oh my gosh. What was like, were the repercussions at home?
Yeah, there'll be repercussions. There'll be a few slaps and a few hittings that go on just to kind of teach you a lesson. But then you go on and you do what you want to do. I remember in eighth grade, I just shot up 1 year. I'm tall. I'm like 5'8".
That's giant for a South Asian
Giant for a South Asian person. Because everybody, my dad was very tall. Like, everybody's, like, pretty tall in our family. My mom's 5'6". My dad's, like, 6'6".
What?
Yeah, so all my nieces are, like, giants. They're, like, huge, you know. My oldest brother's daughter is, she's what, like 20, right? 18, 19, 20 years old. She's like 5'10", 5'11".
Oh my goodness.
Our family's like just giants.
My family's like pocket sized. I'm 5'2", and I'm the tallest one. My dad's like 5'2". My mom's just under 5'2". My sisters are like 5 feet tall. So no. I go home and I'm the one who has to reach things that are high up sitting at 5'2".
No way. That is so funny. No, our family is like, everybody's like a giant. My mom's the shortest person in our family. She's 5'6".
Oh my God. That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, everybody's like giants in our family, but we're all just, but it's interesting because I would get in a lot of trouble. Like I beat this kid up one day. So one year I just shot up in eighth grade and I was really tall, right? I was taller than my teacher. I still have that photo. I'm standing next to my teacher and I'm taller than her. And I think the teacher was barely 5'6", right?
Uh-huh.
I'm like this giant lanky kid, like just standing there and all these like short guys. And this kid kept picking on me. And he kept calling me a giraffe.
Oh, no.
And I was like, oh, hell no. This is going down. I told him, I was like, if you call me a giraffe one more time, I'm going to kick the crap out of you during lunchtime. And he goes, what are you going to do, huh? I was like, you're going to find out. So come lunchtime, I went and hid myself behind the classroom door. And as he came out, I grabbed him by his collar and I beat the shit out of him.
Did he survive?
We became friends after that because he just needed to be taught a lesson that you don't
get. Wow.
We became friends. We became actually really good friends. He was like, you beat me up. I was like, you kept picking on me. I had to teach you a lesson.
Was it like a clock to the side of the face, like in the nose?
It was a clock. It was a clock. It was like right in his nose. I just grabbed him by his collar and just went, pow. I was like, he was like, why'd you do that? I was like, you kept picking on me. I was like, you're calling me names. I'm going to show you who's boss.
Gosh.
I think I was also just those are just like the tomboy things, you know?
Yeah.
Because you see your brothers do it. So you're like, why can't I do it? Guys do it.
Have you ever gotten in a physical, like a fight in your adult life, like a bar fight?
I sure have.
Really? Tell me more. It's like kind of my dream.
No.
To get in a bar fight?
No, not as an adult. I did not pick the fight. The person came and picked a fight with me.
Okay.
It was a racist attack at the center. This lady came and she attacked me. She was spewing racial slurs at me. I thought she was spewing racial slurs at somebody else because I couldn't understand why she would pick on me. And I was like,
yeah,
why you would talk to me? Like, how would you even know like what ethnicity I am? Because there's a lot of Persians here. I could be like anything. I could be Latina. I could be anything.
Yeah.
And this lady came and picked a fight with me and she attacked me. And when she attacked me, she yanked my neck so badly that she herniated a disc in my neck. And after like 5 years, I had to have a neck surgery and they had to cut me open and put a metal disc in my neck.
Oh my gosh.
You don't trust me. You don't want to be in a fight.
What happened to her?
Nothing. Nothing happened to her.
Ugh.
Nothing happened to her. They just let her walk. Nothing happened.
Oh my gosh.
They were just like, we don't have enough evidence. We don't have enough evidence that it's a hate crime. Because did you know that for a hate crime to be considered a hate crime, it has to be on video with an audio person saying, I hate your brown Muslim ass and I want you out of this country or whatever the crap racist people say. And they're like, oh, okay, now it counts as a hate crime.
If someone happens to be filming it while it happened.
So we had the whole thing on video, but if there was no audio because it was a security camera.
Yeah.
And even though you can see that she attacks me first and she's a very rich white lady and she got herself off and nothing happened to her.
Oh my gosh. Were there witnesses?
There sure were witnesses and the witnesses were like, the witness is the one who called the cops and she was like, you know, this woman came and attacked her, and they were like, yeah, no. Sorry, no.
Oh my gosh.
We're going to leave her go. So yeah, as an adult, trust me, you don't want to get into a fight. But
okay, I changed my mind.
Yeah, you don't want to be a part of that. You know, you don't want to be a part of that. But do you feel, Nora, like now that like you've been going to therapy and, you know, does it feel like, I don't know, did it did you have stuff about like being emotionally available or meeting or meeting people who are emotionally? Because for me, the longest time, my problem was because I grew up with men like that who are emotionally unavailable. So those are the men that I was attracted to for the longest time.
Yeah. You know, I think I think I'm the one who has been emotionally unavailable for sure. And I've been told, even recently by a friend, not even, you know, a romantic partner, just a friend was like, you know, you're not very good at, not very, that's not the right term, but like, you don't really tell people, like, you don't tell me how, like, how much you love me, or like, you don't express like positive emotion towards me. Mm-hmm. I'm a very happy, positive, bubbly person about like life and stuff. But I'm not going to like look at my friends in the face and be like, I love you so much. Aww. So it's very hard for me to express positive emotions towards other people verbally. I'll do it physically. I spend time with you. Sure. I get, like, in terms of love languages.
Yeah.
I like to give my quality time. I like to give gifts. I cannot give you words of affirmation.
Okay.
I'm working on that. But weirdly enough, my love language I like to receive is words of affirmation. So I need people to tell me why they love me, even though I can't dish it out. What a great question.
That's interesting. That's so interesting. So I love the five languages of love. I love that book so much. I'm going to go back and listen to it again.
Yeah.
I just love it so much. And I think for me, it's acts of service. Number one. Like, I think it just kind of hands down is like acts of service. Gifts don't really do much for me, but like, you know, acts of service and words of affirmation. Those are my two things.
How do you like to give love? Also with those two?
Acts of service. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. If I really love you and care for you, I will cook you a feast.
Yes.
That's my way of saying I fucking love you. Like, I would, like, do this for you because I really love you and care for you.
Yeah. For sure. I feel that.
I mean, did you guys not have that kind of words of affirmation thing growing up? Like, your parents weren't like, you're beautiful, you're smart, you're amazing, go get it.
So there was always support, especially for, like, you know, school, music competitions. My parents would always, you know, say they're proud of us, you did so well, you're, you know, great job. But there wasn't like the emotional expression, like, I love you, this is how I feel about you. It was about these external, like, things that we did, but not about us.
Right.
So, like, exchanging I love yous is not a thing that my family does or did growing up. And my sisters and I realized this several years ago. The three of us were together in my older sister's house. We were hanging out. We're like, we never have told each other we love each other. And, like, why? We should start doing that. So, like, recently we've decided, like, we're going to tell each other we love each other, even though our parents struggle to say that just generally, not just to us, just generally.
It's just
not a thing.
And by the way, Nora, you know, it's not like that it's just your, you know, you guys, this like exclusive thing that happens to your family. This is a South Asian culture thing,
right?
Because we are not, as much as we love Bollywood and love stories and all that crap and people singing by the fucking trees, you know, we also are a culture that is not very much, very big on emoting and expressing how we feel about people.
Exactly. Exactly.
You
know,
it's like you keep it with, you don't talk about family problems.
No.
Because what are people going to say?
Right, right.
You keep everything inside, even if it's something shameful. So you definitely don't talk about it. You know, you keep everything inside. You don't make yourself vulnerable because vulnerability means weakness.
Right.
And which is the opposite. Really, if you grow up as an adult and you're an evolved human being, you're just like, no, vulnerability means it's strength. Vulnerability means I get to connect with another person.
Exactly. And that makes conflict and arguments really hard to resolve in our culture, I think, is because you're not expressing to the other person, like, you said this thing that made me angry, and this is why I'm feeling that way. This is why you have made me uncomfortable or sad. It's just like an endless tension, I guess, because you're not talking about how you feel. You're just talking about the thing that happened.
That's correct. Yeah. And, you know, and that's a very interesting point you made about, like, how your parents would be like, good job on this and good job on that. And it's interesting because, look, your parents love you. It's clear that they love you.
Yeah.
But, you know, and our parents love us in the way that they best know how, right? They did the best they could, and you love them for that. But I think what it also does, I think subconsciously, at least it did for me, that it puts you in, like, this kind of conditional place where it's just like, only if I do X, Y, and Z will you give me that compliment. So in other yes. words, in other words, what I am, and just as I am, and just my existence is right. enough. I yeah. have to be always above and beyond and extraordinary and amazing, do these amazing things to constantly get any kind of words of affirmation or any kind of verbal love from you to be like, no, you're beautiful. You're amazing. Even if you don't do anything, just the way you are, you're enough. And I think
yeah.
you see a lot of South Asian kids and people grow up with this thing where it's like you don't feel enough because you always have yep. to do something mm-hmm. in order to receive love.
Are you a therapist?
Yes.
This is amazing. You've like hit the nail on the head. You're absolutely right. And I think that's part of like why I constantly feel like at work, If I'm just like breezing by, I'm like, this is not enough. I need a new show, a new project, always looking for like the next thing because that's how I get approval. Like for my parents is being high achieving, being the best. That's the first person I call if something good happens to me at work is like my mom so she can praise me because that's like my fuel. Same with relationships, like romantic relationships too, which is something I work through with my therapist is I've always had this like checklist mm-hmm. of items that I need in a partner because that's what like my mom would like me to bring home to her is like mm-hmm. XYZ education, XYZ aesthetic, height, all those things. And only when I realized that the checklist was for my mom did I realize that I need to get rid of that and just connect with someone on like a personal level and not what they look like on paper and how impressed my mom would be with them.
That's correct. So it boils back to like that kind of conditional love, right?
Uh-huh.
Only if I do X, Y, and Z, will you love me? And it's like, why wouldn't you just love me just because I'm your kid? And I love you just because you're my mom. Like, I don't have to do anything for you, and you don't have to do anything for me. Just our existence is enough.
Oh my gosh. I'm going to say that to myself every night now before I get to bed. My existence is enough. I am enough.
Listen, Nora, listen, all joking aside, this shit is powerful. It really is, you know, because it, you know, we're talking about like that kind of 0 to 5 year of age, which is what where we learn all these things. Mm-hmm. You know, they say that whatever you learn from the age of 0 to 5 is the person you're going to be for the rest of your life, you know, and it's this kind of cultural conditioning. And this kind of subconscious thing that, you know, that sits in our subconscious about who we are and what our worth is, you know. I mean, look, it took me a long time to figure this out. Like a long time. After years and years in the therapy. And I'm just like, oh, got it. God, I always have to overachieve. I always have to be extraordinary for you to come out and say that I am worthy, that I am of value, that you love me. And just like you, I think I came to the realization where it's just like, I'm not going to make a list. I don't want to have this list to impress my family, you know?
Right.
It's about how does this person make me feel and how am I in this relationship?
Yeah, exactly. If I had been able to hear a conversation like this, like 10, 15 years ago, I would have saved myself a lot of trouble.
Sure.
And that goes back to the value of having different voices.
That's correct.
In news, in media, movies, whatever. I've started seeking out, you know, content that does focus on even, I don't know if you've heard of this show called Code Switched. I'm going to email you about it after.
Yeah.
It's a small, you know, independent group of brown people who made this show about growing up as South Asians in the U.S. Yeah. And it's like they have these kinds of conversations on that show, but I had never seen it before. Mm-hmm. And I would have loved to know that other people are going through these things that I'm going through. You just end up feeling kind of alone and different if everyone around you is like, you know, like in Minnesota, most people around me were white and didn't have these problems. So yeah, I'm glad we get to talk about this kind of thing more in a more public way.
Yeah, I feel like there's also like this sense of, I think more and more now we're like coming out and talking about it and verbalizing it, but I feel like I feel like there is still so much stigma. There is still so much. I can definitely speak on behalf, you know, in the Pakistani culture and what I don't know how it is in Bangladeshi culture, which I would think it's not so much different than Pakistani culture. There's still like that thing of, we don't talk about our problems. we don't tell people what stuff we're going through. We don't talk.
Right.
Because I think a lot of people don't realize that when we come from, either when we're immigrants or first generation, you know, we're literally living two lives.
Yeah.
In a certain way when we go, when you are an anchor on Cheddar, you are this different version of Nora than the Nora that shows up in front of her parents' house in Minnesota.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. You have to be this good Bangladeshi girl who's obedient and who's good and who's, you know, does the right thing. And, oh, mom and dad, I did all this amazing stuff. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's like you're like tap dancing for your parents.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Your life. And you're, after a while, you're just like, this is exhausting.
It is exhausting. Yeah, and it's, you don't have that many people you can talk to about it. That's why my sisters and I are so close, is because we very much related to each other for many in many ways. So
that's right. And you guys also grew up in the same household, so you can talk about a lot of, you know, similar things where you're just like, you feel that way when that incident happened, and you're like, oh my god, no, I didn't, I completely forgot about it. Because it's interesting when I have conversations with my brother about it, and he's like, that's not how I remembered it. Or, oh, do you remember it that way? Oh, I don't remember it that way. I remember it with Wendy. And it was like, oh, interesting.
Did your brothers cover for you if you were like doing something you weren't supposed to do?
Cover for me?
Yeah, like confirm your alibi.
Not really.
No.
No, not really. We were throwing each other under the bus all day.
Oh.
We're like, fuck this guy. He did. Let him out. We had a rule in our house that if my mom, of course, this is in Pakistan because you can't pull that shit here. My mom had a rubber pipe to keep us all in check. Yeah. She had a rubber pipe. Okay. And and if we stepped out of line, there were rubber pipes that were going to hit our bodies. We kept in check. So we had this rule in the house. If one kid fucks up, everybody gets a beating.
Oh, wow.
So my mom was playing like these mind games on us, and it was like, if one kid fucks up and everybody gets a beating, so then everybody has to keep the other one in check. So we're all policing each other.
Oh, okay.
Like living in fucking communist China or some shit. You're like, where am I existing right now? What is this? We're all snitching on each, like, what is this?
My sisters and I were the opposite. We had each other's backs and like,
have
not once thrown either of them under the bus. Not once. And they've never thrown me under the bus.
No.
Ride or die.
Yeah, no, not at all. Not for us, I think. Maybe it's also different because it's also more like maybe feminine energy. So it's like, because your dad is the only dude in the house.
Right. Dad was the only dude.
He's the only dude. For us, I'm like the only girl. Who's really a girl? Who's more like a tomboy? So I think I think it's like so different.
For sure.
I mean, Nora, I think it would be amazing. I think you should go and pitch to Cheddar that you should start a whole section about or a whole show about stuff that you grew up with and the shit that immigrant kids kind of grow up as in these two kind of worlds. Because a lot of people don't know, right? If you're a Caucasian person or even a black person in America, right? You don't know like that kind of immigrant side of how you have to live like these two dual lives.
It is a unique experience, yeah. And it's just a good time to talk about immigrant experience too, right? We're going from the least immigration-friendly administration in recent memory to having a vice president who is the child of immigrants. So it couldn't be more different. So it seems like a good time to talk about it.
Yeah, it's absolutely a great time to talk about it. So Nora, we're going to wrap up. So where are you? You're on Cheddar, what is it, 5 days a week?
Yeah, from Monday through Friday. My usual shows are from 12 to 2 Eastern Time and 3 to 4:30 Eastern Time PM. Just go to cheddar.com. You can find me on Instagram at Nora Ali, on Twitter at Nora K. Ali. Just Google Cheddar Nora and you can find me. Easy.
Cheddar Nora. Absolutely.
Cheddar Nora.
The big cheese, the cheddar.
I hope so, yes.
No, I had such a great conversation. I'd love to bring you back on again soon and talk to you about updates that are going on for you.
Yeah, awesome. This was so fun. Thank you for this. Was like a therapy session.
I somehow end up turning my episodes somehow end up turning into fun therapy sessions.
Yeah. Well, you ask great questions and then you're able to extrapolate what I'm saying into like takeaways and action items. So thank you.
Takeaways and action items. I don't think anyone has ever like summarized it in the way that you do it right now. That's amazing. That's the Harvard teaching right there. See, I'm a college. I would know. James said, thanks, Nora. And Sarah, thanks, Nora. Mora, I guess.
Nora a little Sarah, right rhyme, I guess.
Exactly. And he said, yes, great therapy session. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm glad. Nora, it was a pleasure, my friend. Thank you very much for tuning in.
Thank you again, Mona. We will talk soon.
All right.
Have a good weekend.
Thank you, too. Take care.
Bye.
That was the lovely Nora Ali. I hope you guys enjoyed that mini therapy session we had. I definitely did. I love talking to smart, accomplished people and learning about their lives and kind of relating to them. You guys, if you haven't followed me on YouTube yet, please do. You can follow me on YouTube at Mona Shake Comedian. Mark, Mona Shake is truly amazing. Thank you, Mark. So are you. Thank James, you are awesome. Thank you very much for everybody who's tuned in. I will see you guys on Monday, and I am actually doing a stand-up comedy competition that I've posted on my Facebook if you guys want to join me. I also have a show tomorrow I'm doing at 7 p.m. Pacific. It's a free show. I'm going to show up. It's called KO Comedy. You can tune in. It's a free show, and I posted the link on my Facebook for my comedy competition I'm doing today at 6:30 p.m. You guys, have a great weekend. Stay safe out there. See you on Monday.